Thank you for tuning in, boys and girls, friends and listeners, wherever you might be. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm your host, Henrik Palmgren, and redice.tv. That's where you can go to hear more radio, see our videos, our live TV show. We have news and much more on the website as well. Thank you for being here. We have what I think will be a very, very interesting show for you guys today. We're going to put some focus on actually a movie premiering here on December 21st, on the winter solstice of all days. Assassin's Creed, based on the hugely popular video game franchise by the same name. And this is a very interesting backstory to this and to the game. It follows, you know, a centuries-old struggle between assassins and Templars. And the assassins, of course, has a root with the Hashashins within the Islamic world. We're going to get into detail about this and kind of break down kind of the backstory to the movie. And maybe some potential why it's been so popular as well. But our guest with us helped to detail some of this is Patrick LeBrun. He's been with us before on the show. He's a writer and an activist who has written a lot for Countercurrents, but also for other publications. He has extensive experience with the French identitarian movement. He's currently based in the U.S., where he mentors college students who wish to engage in activism. Welcome back, Patrick. Good to have you with us on the show again.
Yeah, great to be here, and great to be here under much better circumstances than usual, because normally we're talking after some horrible terrorist attack, or talking about, you know, the details of Wahhabism and Islamist terrorists, but now we have something a bit more of a entertaining, engaging story from that part of the world we can talk about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. None of that has happened yet, and it's been pretty calm so far in terms of all the Christmas rush in the Western world, and I hope we can avoid some of that. I hope you, by the way, be able to spend some time with your loved ones as well during this hectic period of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. That's coming up next week. It's a Saturday. Yeah, you got it.
Amazing, huh? Yeah. So the Assassin's Creed, you know, it's primarily revolves around the rivalry between two ancient secret societies, the Assassins and the Knights Templar, and the kind of the indirect relationship to another kind of species. Actually, a lot of these topics that we're going to get into today, Patrick, is things that we've spoken about a lot on the show through the years, you know, since we started in 2006 with the radio shows. I was always very interested in things that came from the ancient and classical world, esoteric subjects, occult subjects, things that had to do with human nature and the early days of developments of civilization and things like this. And this story is kind of right at the heart of that. It looks like the game producers, I think it was out of Montreal or Canada somewhere, that came up with a game idea, and we just briefly spoke before the show. It seemed that they were the kind of the guys who were listening to shows like ours, shows like Coast to Coast and some of these other shows as well, Patrick.
Absolutely. They could not have come up with what they came up with in their story without input from you and your many guests and that whole milieu. You know, it's based on actual historical groups, but then they add in other elements to it, like this occult warfare between Templars and Assassins over the big idea of, to save humanity, do you have to control them, or can you let them be free and let them follow their will and follow their interests, right? And that's the axis around which this whole story turns in Assassin's Creed, and you pop in on this warfare throughout history, starting with the Crusades, and then hitting all of these other major events in history. There's Renaissance Italy, there's the colonization of the New World and the Caribbean, there's the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Industrial Revolution in Britain. I'm not familiar with all of them, but today we can really focus on the earlier parts where it's closer to the historical narrative. We can talk about where it's similar, where it's different, and also talk about some of the other, let's say, creative minds who went to work trying to add, to embellish the story as well. And then, of course, the Assassins are based on a religious sect that's still around today. They're called the Ismailis. And their story is 1,500 years long and interesting the whole way through. It's really like an adventurous, colorful tale. And but the beginning of the tale of Assassin's Creed is kind of a frame tale where you have a modern-day guy who gets brought in to be experimented on in this machine, where they look at his ancestral memories. And this is an idea that you've talked about on your show when you had Steve McNallan on.
Yeah, that's right. Metagenetics.
That's right, yeah. And that's, you know, I'd never heard anyone use that phrase before Steve McNallan. But metagenetics, and he had this continuum as well that was talked about, you know, you had learned behaviors on one end, and then somewhere in the middle is your, you know, DNA genotype and how that impacts a person. And then on, you know, the other extreme end was this metagenetics, which is kind of an ancestral imprint that's based on, just the experience of the ancestors. The way they do it in this game is that the character has to go into a kind of, you know, medically induced trance, and he relives the experiences of his ancestors. And the nefarious goal of the people making him doing this is to see, they want to retrieve an item, and by having him retrace the steps of his ancestor, they will figure out where that and other items were hidden so they can go and seek them out. But yeah, this idea of metagenetics, there really is something to it, I think. And it's actually in France as well. It's been an area of research. I have a relative, actually, who's a psychologist, and he spends a lot of time on this. They don't go back 1,000 years in what they do, but they usually go back 3 or 4 generations, and they try to find, let's say, narratives that are continuous in the family history, whether it's like struggles with authority or with, you know, a certain kind of relationship that repeatedly falls apart, you know, generation after generation, and they work through it that way. And but yeah, this whole concept, I think anyone who's at all interested in this stuff should listen to the Steve McNallan interview. He's the head of the Ossetru Folk Assembly. If you probably know more about that, being a Nordic man yourself, here as Yule approaches.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true. Yule is coming up. You know, I think Stephen has, I know that Stephen actually has stepped down right now as head of the AFA. And I know that he's going to pursue some other goals and I think branch out a little bit more into politics. But, you know, one of the shows that we did, as you said, it was on metagenetics. And it was one of the more interesting ones that I've heard. And it really, it was a very interesting, like a metaphysical discussion around the idea of ancestry and the importance of our genetic line, you know. And as far as I understood so far, I've only seen the trailer. And I have not played any of the video games, never had time to do that, but I think that they also kind of obviously tie in this idea. It's almost like that they're doing some kind of gene travel, right? It's the analysis of the genetic memory, and it's something with the main character's bloodline, I guess, that actually is important. So within this whole story, you kind of have an idea of continuity through bloodlines or through the genetic line, if you will.
Right, right. Would this be a good time to play the trailer then? We can have the listeners have it here for themselves, and then we'll follow up with it.
Yeah, let's do that. And, of course, as always, folks, you know, some of these trailers are always really cheesy, and there's a lot of, you know, fighting and everything else. But listen to some of the points that's kind of underneath here, and we'll discuss that afterwards. So here we go.
You're here to save my soul.
I understand it's your birthday.
Yeah. The party's just getting started.
His name is Callum Lynch. We've traced his bloodline back 500 years to the Assassin's Creed.
As anyone in the world knows or cares, you no longer exist.
What is this place?
This is your second chance.
What do you want from me?
Your past. You're about to enter the Animus. What you see, hear, and feel are the memories of your ancestor, who's been dead for 500 years.
Wait a minute!
Welcome to the Spanish Inquisition.
Watching you, waiting to see who you are.
I believe you are destined for great things.
Let's find out. We work in the dark to serve the light.
Yeah, so there we go. So obviously there's a lot of action scenes in that and everything else, but it's still, you know, underneath there's something pretty interesting, and I also find it interesting that they're positioning this kind of struggle that it seems like to kind of have something to do with the Western world and the Islamic world, you know, some kind of echo of the past and almost something that we're, of course, continuing to face into this day.
Right, right. And yeah, it is kind of a photo negative of what we're looking at politically right now, where, you know, you have a politically repressive Wahhabi system in Saudi Arabia and in you know, the Islamic State versus, you know, like a liberal democratic kind of system in the West. And what they present is kind of a photo negative of that, where you have the assassins are the ones who are serving human freedom, and the European Templars are the ones who are, I should say, you know, you have Europeans on both sides, but the ones who are more, you know, Christian and associated with Europe are the ones who are fighting against freedom. But
right, I was wondering about that. I read about that first, and I was like, wait a minute, are they saying that they're saying that the kind of the Islamic tradition of the Hashashins is kind of that's what's going to, the fate of the world hangs on these people, right?
Right, yeah. And there are others who are, you know, like there's a guy named James Wasserman. We can talk about this a little bit later when we talk about the Crusades. But they think, and this is a really popular idea in France amongst a lot of Masons, is this idea that the Assassins and the Templars were actually best buddies, and they're actually secretly the same group altogether. And Bill Cooper had that idea too, actually.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But you know, I think that to get an idea of why, or how could they possibly make this claim that there's such an Islamic group that thinks that way, is to look at the roots of Shia Islam and the roots of this branch that broke off of it, the Ismailis. And I think that, you know, probably a lot of people have seen sights of people walking down a street with blades that they swing on their backs, right, and blood is flowing out. You know, that you've seen this, right, of Ashura, right, when you have these guys walking the streets. And that's something that only the Shia do, and it's all about this one particular event that's kind of the moment that they were born in blood, if you will. And that is when the grandson of Muhammad and the son of Ali, when he was leaving his hometown, he was going to Iraq. His father was the third caliph. He was the one that's preferred by the Shia, and they thought that he's both a secular and also a religious figure. The Sunnis, the vast majority of Muslims, accept all of the early caliphs as being rightly guided by God. And Ali was killed while at prayer, just a few years into his tenure as caliph. And then, you know, not so long after that, you know, you have one of his sons, who was the leader of that community, as they say, was poisoned. And then the other one decides, all right, I'm gonna get out of town with my family and go to a place where I have, you know, people who will protect me, where I can live in peace. And on the way there, he's stopped by the forces of the caliph, Muawiyah, and he is basically, they're surrounded, they are denied access to water, even their infant baby can't drink, and then eventually they are attacked and massacred. And only one of their, you know, hidden children who was not there survived. And that's kind of that really key moment for them. And it's kind of a moment, it's an act of penance, because it is almost kind of an act, you know, a metagenetics belief, because they're thinking that, okay, I was not present at that battle with him, just as their ancestors didn't go to the battle to protect this, you know, small group of 80 or so family members who were going across the desert.
Right.
Because they're supported, they did ask for help from their supporters who they're going to visit, and no one came out of fear. And then this terrible massacre of men, women, and children happened. And actually, when they tell this tale, I'm making light of it a little bit, but, you know, you can't be a good Shia cleric unless you can cry on command. Because when they tell this story, and all of, if for the Twelvers, all 12 of their imams were killed, whether poisoned or, you know, tortured to death in prison or killed in the battlefield like this, all of them were killed. And as they tell their stories, at some point they have to cry, and also the audience must cry as well. And it is actually, I mean, it is a sad story. And I remember the first time I heard it, and it was like a really moving speaker telling it. I had like a, you know, tear in my eye. And then he said, if you have a tear in your eye the size of a mosquito, then your place in paradise is assured. So I thought, well, if these guys are right, I'm good. Okay, I'm safe. And,
oh, good.
But, yeah. But, so, you know, there's this, after Ali, there were no, and until the Fatimid Empire, there was no one from this line who ever got into power. But there was always this fear on the part of the Sunni regime, which was, you know, the mainstream Islam, that they would have natural sympathy, they would gather support, that they were a political threat. And so one of them, there's a guy named Jafar as-Sadiq, who's one of the imams recognized by everyone. He's the sixth imam, okay? So he's recognized by Twelvers, by Ismailis, by many, many of these sects. And he's kind of the beginning of intellectual Islam. Because you have to think about it, like, you know, I mean, I think a lot of your listeners are familiar with, you know, the acts of Muhammad. I mean, these guys are kind of like desert traders who were really violent, rough characters, right?
Yeah.
These are not like Thomas Aquinas or St. Francis of Assisi, right, these guys. And this guy who is, you know, the sixth imam, which would make him, you know, seven generations after Muhammad, he basically had a little school where he taught people, almost like a Greek-style school, you know, where he would just, you know, people would pay and he would just give lectures there in his courtyard. And two of the schools of Sunni jurisprudence come from him. They were students of his their schools of jurisprudence are named after his students. Both schools of Shia jurisprudence come from him, right? They're, you know, named after him or students of his. And also the great alchemist, really like the father of alchemy, a guy named Jabir ibn Hayyan, and he's known in, if anyone who's, you know, an alchemist reading European stuff, that he's called Geber, G-E-B-E-R, by the Europeans.
Okay.
And he was a student of Jafar as-Sadiq as well. And so, you know, the guy was really like a polymath. And he was really like the font of a lot of this this stuff. And which is definitely like not in keeping with, let's say, the culture of the rest of Islam at that time.
Right. So this grows out of an environment where, well, either there was this kind of a security in what they've conquered already, so some of mm-hmm. the ancient knowledge from the classical world began right. to kind of simmer through again, because we may remember much of the kind of advancements that Islam did is, of course, thanks to the fact that they colonized and took over a lot of these areas that were procurers of this knowledge. And I think, unfortunately, though, much of it was lost when they were conquered by Islam.
Yeah, much was lost. I think from all the Abrahamic religions, unfortunately, had a negative impact on it. Now, you know, and in speaking of, you know, one of these fonts of the ancient wisdom, I mean, you know, you have to talk about, you know, we'll talk about Egypt in a second, but the other is Babylon, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of those early groups after Jaffa Sadiq, there is this, you know, like this, I guess you could say it's the first secret society within Islam. It's called the Brotherhood of Purity. And that was like the late 8th century to the early 10th century. And they created works. They're claimed by the Ismailis. They're claimed by other Shia as well as being theirs. And frankly, it would make sense because their major works, linguists today say, you know, it's written in Arabic, but it looks like it was written by Persians, right?
Right.
Just because, you know, they keep the language very simple, or they're using lots of Persian loan words, or they're making, well, I mean, you know how there's, like, if I'm talking to somebody who's flipping their adjective and their noun, right, in a different way than you'd see in English, typically, you're like, okay, well, that's how they do it in Spanish, or that's how they do it in French, right?
Right.
You know, anyone who's learned another language, you see that they're kind of order differences in some of these things. And they catch these, and these are guys who are like the leading lights of philosophy and alchemy and theology and medicine. And they're making these linguistic mistakes, right, as they're writing. And these are smart guys, but they're making grammar mistakes. So they're saying, like, okay, these are probably Persians. And then they disappear. And they disappear kind of at the beginning of the Fatimid Empire. And before I jump to those guys, I'll tell you, they have this little, one of their surviving lines that's kind of entertaining. They talked about the ideal man, right? And they say that he is East Persian of derivation, Arabic of faith, Iraqi, that is Babylonian, in education, Hebrew in astuteness, a disciple of a disciple of Christ in conduct, pious as a Syrian monk, Greek in natural sciences, and Indian in the interpretation of the mysteries, and above all, a mystic in his whole spiritual outlook. So, very different mindset than the, you know, these former traders, these Bedouins, these you know, guys who came off the trade routes and then exploded with you know, this physical force to take over all this territory around them.
Yeah,
and that's kind of a mindset that you see in the Fatimids, and where they're, like you said, you just put it well. You know, you said that, you know, they got a lot of territory where a lot of these achievements happened, and so the question is, are these guys going to realize that they may be stronger, but they've just conquered their intellectual betters, or are they going to be like, oh well, hey, I'm God's on my side, you know, you're an idiot, you know, and punch him in the face and take his wife, right? You know, and these are the two possibilities. Unfortunately, both of them happen, and unfortunately, the second kind of guy seem to be have the upper hand in the long term in that part of the world.
Yeah.
But the with the Fatimids, you know, there's a lot of, like, how do I put this? An open question. They claim that it's super clear, and the Ismailis as well. They claim it's super clear that, you know, that this person was Imam and the leader of the Shia faithful. He indicated this son, who then led them, and indicated this son, and led them. But in fact, when you look at the actual record, there are all these gaps. And so, you know, just for me, like, you know, I'm a little bit of a skeptic, maybe in saying this, but I think it's entirely feasible. That and you know, we're talking about, you know, wealthy Muslims here, even though they might be a little bit more intellectual than their, you know, than their Umayyad cousins, right? But they're going to have a harem and a whole lot of wives, right?
Yeah.
And so every one of these imams is going to have dozens of kids who have dozens of kids who have hundreds of kids, and you're going through these phases where they kind of disappear from the political scene, and then they come back. And then we're told by court historians, like, oh, well, all along, that guy's grandfather, then his father, then him, were the imams, right? And there's a bit, probably, of you know, just, you know, you had these hundreds of guys who were from this family line. One of them made good, and so he's going to claim this title, and that's going to give him the spiritual legitimacy on top of the political force that got him in power.
Right.
And that's, I think that's what happened with this, the first of the Fatimids. He's considered the 11th Imam only by the Ismailis and a couple other sects, not by 12ers. So not like the people in Lebanon or the people in Iran, like they're a different group now. They've had a schism by this point. He's their 11th Imam. His mother was unknown, and then the three generations of men before him were in occultation. So you see what I'm saying here? Like, I'm thinking that there's a gap here. That, you know, and I'm going to walk through the Fatimid story and talk about the mysticism of that era, and then we're going to get to the Crusades. We're going to talk more about this, what's truth and what's fiction in the Assassin's Creed, right? And what's truth and what's fiction in the Templar-Assassin connection. But basically what he did was that he and his coterie around him, they organized merchants really well in this area around Tunisia, and they also got a lot of Berbers who are not Arabs, right? And they're definitely much more backwards at that point in time, and definitely much more illiterate, right? And scraping out an existence in the rougher terrain in the countryside. And they created a sovereign territory there, right? Which is kind of a territory that, wasn't really sought after. So, a territory that's not wealthy with mines and so on. That's one of the themes that we'll see coming up over and over again with them, is that they have this kind of double-pronged approach of getting, merchants and then some very backwards peasant caste, right, of people, right? And so they had this, and they controlled this area around, their waters just off of their coasts. And in a time when, the line between merchant and pirate was pretty hard to tell, right?
Right.
And so, and they developed this merchant fleet, and the Berbers were becoming, more and more faithful. They were being trained in how to work the merchant fleets. They're making a better life, raiding on ships on the Mediterranean trade between, Europe and Byzantium than they were raising goats out in the mountains. And so they're moving towards this direction, right? And then the Bulgarians decide they want to invade the Byzantine Empire, okay? And this is around, 969 is when this happens. And they reach out to these guys and they say, look, we're going to do the land invasion. You guys do naval, and we'll split the goods, right? And so, this is something that happens also again and again in their history. It's another theme that we see is that they're willing to make alliances with anybody against their enemies to advance their cause, or even against people they don't care about. They're not even
exactly
their cause, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they had nothing against Byzantium. These guys, in fact, Byzantium was the enemy of their enemy. Right, because their real enemy is the Sunni caliphs, who they feel have usurped their rightful position. And so they go on this this war, and that's how they win Sicily. Actually, that's when Sicily became under their control as the Emirate of Sicily in part of Italy today. And they and then from there they continued to expand. They eventually took over Egypt and based their empire in Cairo. They were the founders of Al-Azhar University. I should say, at the beginning, they had lots of purges of their enemies, certainly, religious purges. But they moved towards, like we talked about earlier, they realized they were conquering their intellectual betters. And so they allowed for a pluralism that made their empire a center of alchemy, astrology, architecture, science.
And that was seemed not have been maybe, that was definitely not a plan. It was like a side effect, right?
I'm not 100% sure, honestly. Because I do think that they had these links with the Brotherhood of Purity. They have this lineage from Jafar Asadiq. I think that they they had this in mind of like a different vision for government. Now, it's kind of paradoxical that on one time, you know, it's, if it's possible, even more autocratic than the Sunni approach, because you're not just dealing with the biggest, you know, toughest guy, you're also dealing with a guy who God said is supposed to be in charge, and he's the biggest, toughest guy, right?
Right.
And there's less legalism in this tradition, right? They're less turning, you know, you don't have this focus on these, you know, reading through hadith and everything, because they say, like, well, we don't need that because we have the imam here with us. He can tell us what the ruling is supposed to, he can tell us what God thinks, right? We don't need to, you know, piece through these texts to piece together a some kind of legal judgment, which is what the Sunni approach was. And at that point, after the disappearance of the 12th Imam, that's the approach of the Twelvers, right? The Iranian style Shiites.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but you know, at the one time you have this kind of, you know, autocratic or totalitarian rule. But then on the other hand, the enforcement for much of their history of, you say, the restrictions of Sharia, right? Or their enforcement of, you know, narrow intellectual worldview is a lot less, you know. And yeah, and this is one of the ironies too. You have so many apologists today who decry the clash of civilizations, right? I'm not sure they've read more than the title of that book by
right.
Sam Hunt, by the way.
Right.
But they're always complaining about the clash of civilizations. They think that pointing out that a historian is an Orientalist is kind of like the beginning and end of an argument, just calling him a name. And they're always pointing to bad stuff Europeans did 800 years ago and good stuff they did 800 years ago, right?
Yeah.
They love to talk about this Islamic Golden Age, but the thing is, like, this Islamic Golden Age was carried out by a group that is now less than 1% of the world's Muslims.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And a group that was, like, tirelessly persecuted by 80%, the ancestors of 80% of today's Muslims, right?
Yeah.
So it is, there's a bit of a intellectual dishonesty in their claiming this Islamic Golden Age all for themselves.
And they think it's going to continue to come in its wake of the current form that it is, you know?
Yeah. Definitely not. Definitely not. Yeah. Yeah, and it's also their approach to it seems to have been this. They created a magnet for all of the, you know, in addition to the sciences and philosophy, a magnet for mysticism, which and you know, what like you said, it preexisted in this area of the world, right? But it had to be hidden. It had to be hidden after the. You know, imposition, I think it was Domitian, Emperor Domitian said, you know, after Constantine accepted Christianity and made it official, Domitian said, okay, only Christians from now on. You know, and then you had, of course, in the early years, you know, during these Islamic conquests, you know, destruction of monasteries, destruction of libraries, destruction of statues. You know, this iconoclasm, the destruction of art, is this recurring theme in that part of the world. Even before, even with early Christians, there were iconoclastic movements where they would run through and just destroy paintings and sculptures.
Alexandria, the library, you know, it's
yes.
Tremendous amounts of material from the ancient world that has perished in the hands of these religious fanatics at the time.
Yeah.
They burnt everything, you know?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I don't know how long ago Pythagoras was, but that was really long ago. And the, you know, the priesthoods of Egypt, I mean, that's been a part of that part of the world, both, you know, the European side and the continents of Africa, the continents of, you know, Western Asia, right? A lot was happening there in this period, you know, in the ages before this. And a lot of them survived by becoming, you know, anchorites, right? Or becoming monks, or becoming, you know, kind of practicing in secret, passing it along in very small groups and mountain communities, right? Or in trade guilds, you know? And like the Mandaeans, right? Since the time of John the Baptist, you know, and they eventually became, they cornered the market in goldsmiths, you know.
Right.
So
right.
Almost everyone who was practicing that religion was also a goldsmith at one point. And every goldsmith was practicing that religion. But when this happened, when the Fatimid Empire was going and going strong, they didn't have to hide anymore. And so this was a lot of what produced that intellectual environment. Very little has been written about it, honestly, in, I think, any Western language. But it's a very interesting period of time. And this is kind of my read on it as I kind of try to make sense of historical movements in the area. But when you look at the Druze, we know that comes from one of the imams of the Fatimids, right? This is this kind of mystical secret society religion in the mountainous areas of Lebanon. We know that, after the fall of the Fatimids, there were tons of these Sufi orders that started popping up, and Sufi saints started arriving in these new mountain communities and having this major impact in, this group of shepherds in this particular valley in the Caucasus or in this area of Libya, right? I mean, they're spreading out, and none of it's happening at the center of the empire where it's being suppressed. It's like someone smashed a fist down on this, if you imagine like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, someone smashing a fist down, and then you have little drops flying out to the edges, and that's kind of what happened. I believe so that this was crushed by these Sunni invaders, and then, or the Kabbalah, right, suddenly appears in Spain, which is formerly Fatimid. And, they claim the Kabbalah, the tradition says that it happened at Moses' time, right? It was this super old document. There are no Sephardic Jews who practice Kabbalah. And the reason why is that when they read it, if they know, Ladino, right, they know the language of the Jews at the time, and they know Hebrew, they get that, this was written by someone who's not a Hebrew speaker. Making, like we talked about mistakes of Persian into Arab, they see those kinds of mistakes, and they get the kind of mistakes in grammar that it was written by, in fact, this guy who was a publisher who had some ideas that were out of the ordinary, right, for his community. And then he put them in this frame of saying, it's okay, I'm not weird, this is, thousands of years old, right? So we can all practice it and not be persecuted.
Right, it's a way for this knowledge to continue, and many of those people, they were smart enough at the time to kind of, as you say, they were cloaking it maybe even in the religious framework that they could work with at the time, but it still was enough to kind of preserve some of this ancient knowledge whatever we might think of these traditions or whatever, in a way it's good that someone did these things and passed them on to us,
Right, right. I mean, yeah, and what we're talking about here also is, what the umbrella term for a lot of is Neoplatonism. And that's kind of the story of Neoplatonism, is that there's never a church of Neoplatonism, in the last 2,000 years. It's always hiding in this, small monastery that no one pays attention to, or it's happening in this little circle of Sufi brothers, or it's happening amongst this group of Kabbalists, right? Who are way off the charts, away from their own actual traditions, right? And that's and then of course, where does it come? This guy, this publisher, for example, in Spain, didn't come up with this all on his own. That's where my hypothesis is that, this is just the environment that you had in the Fatimid Empire, and it was out in the open. Then suddenly, when it's crushed, now it's time to cloak this knowledge in, aphorisms and tall tales. Now it's time to make these practices kosher or halal or, mm-hmm. Good Christian behavior. Right? And there's Christian esoteric stuff as well that was passed on. From this time as well. And that brings us, the destruction of the Fatimids, and then this spreading out of, spreading out of these esoteric traditions happened at the same time as the Crusades, and it also happened at the same time as a beginning, I guess if we were to say the closing of the Muslim mind. or maybe that's not the right word, because it started out, like we talked about, you know, this kind of, you know, thuggish, you know, camel traders, right? And there's a guy named Al-Ghazali, who was actually one of the leading minds of his time, and this, you know, great intellectual leader. He was, you know, also a polymath. And there's a tale about how he was traveling in the desert and was traveling with a lot of his manuscripts, and they were set upon by these robbers. And when this happened, the robbers started taking his papers, and they started, you know, messing with them, breaking those. And for him, you know, he was like an intellectual. He didn't care if they took his gold. He can make money, or he can, you know, ask for a donation later on. But when they started destroying his manuscripts and messing with them, he started crying, you know, because that's like, okay, how do you replace something that took all this work that's only written down one thing? And then the guy started mocking him. And, you know, like, oh, you think that, you know, it's like a work of theology. You think that God is on this paper and I'm destroying God for you, or something like this, right? And it sent him into this, like, depression and this kind of, you know, post-traumatic searching, you know. And when he came out on the other side, sadly, he became totally, totally anti-intellectual. And this is like around 1100. And he wrote a very influential book against Neoplatonism and against scientific inquiry. And, you know, he has a very, there's one line in particular, I don't think I have the exact quote, but really famous, and that is that, you know, if scientific inquiry comes up with one solution and the Quran provides a different one, I will go with the Quran every time.
Right.
And so, and that's in keeping with this idea of the Quran as being the word of the angel Gabriel, dictated and unchanging, right? That it can't be, like, understood allegorically,
right,
like the Bible can, right?
Yeah.
And that's really this kind of turning point. You know, there was kind of an other world was possible at one point for that religion if it was seen through this different lens, right, that was provided there for that brief period of time in Egypt and in the Fatimid Empire. And then it's no longer possible, you know. It's only going to be small little Sufi tariqas and little hidden followers of the Imam and this kind of thing, where that's at all possible, and never again in mainstream Islam. And that's also the time that the Crusaders arrive, and also the time that our tale of the Assassin's Creed starts in. Right?
Yeah, so it starts in this period, and as you say, it's a tremendously tumultuous, you know, period. So many things going on at this point, and it's kind of, you know, sad in a way to think that this force is what pervades, you know, in the region. And I guess it must have been the Sunni faction then of this, if you will, that was attacking Europe at the time and were provoking them to initiate the Crusades, right? And that's what maybe one of the reasons why we have this kind of overlap of, you know, the Templars, right? The Catholic,
right,
order that somehow has a reason to take itself into this part of the world, because that's when all these things start to happen. That's the ignition point right there.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, both sides have been involved in conflicts with Europe, and both sides were, when they could be, expansionists. If one was more fanatical than the other, you know, I couldn't say, but and to what extent that's just the nature of man as well, or what extent is the nature of the religion, you know, I think that certainly any interpretation of Islam, but especially the Sunni, would lend itself to being this kind of conquest mentality, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like what that, you know, the Pope Benedict XVI got in trouble for this when he was sitting as Pope, right? He quoted a conversation between a Byzantine emperor and his Islamic captor, and the guy was saying, like, oh, well, this new religion came along and they brought this innovation. So the new religion came along and then they brought this innovation. And he said to the guy, you know, Islam, the only thing they brought was the sword.
Yeah.
And then I've never heard a counterpoint to that. I've heard a lot of people say that's impolite to say. but I've never heard a counterpoint. An interesting criticism, you know. But we find this this character in Assassin's Creed is an assassin at this time when basically this sect has their back against the wall. And they've sent these guys they call Dai, DA-I, which is like missionary. And they've sent them out to different parts of the Muslim world. And they're basically, their goal at that point is find a handful of followers to recruit who are total fanatics, right? Ready to give it all. And then they take these very defensible positions. They do it as Christian monks did, let's say 400 years before. You find these these rocky islands, right, where you have suddenly there's this beautiful building and you have a community of 20 monks living there in this place that was totally unassailable to invaders, right? Only the difference is that the monks were there to pray and to kind of cut themselves off from the chaos of the world at the time. The assassins were plotting their revenge and their return to power, right?
Right.
And from there they would send out, they would use the tactics available to them given the assets they had. And so that meant they were basically stuck with psychological warfare and assassination because they were very few but very, very dedicated, totally unafraid of death. And the character in this, and the characters in the game are actually, the master of the castle is based on an actual person from history who was in charge of this castle. Al-Mualim is what they call him in the game, and he was the master of this castle in Syria. And there was it's not the same as Al-Mut, right? The Eagle's Nest, which was in Persia.
That's in Iran today, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And this was, we're talking about a guy named Rashid Ad-Din Sinan. And a lot of the stories that we hear, they kind of mix up who it is doing it because there's a lot of similarity between their stories because it's all about freaking out the other ruler,
Right.
And it's all about, and this is like another one of these themes from their history is making themselves the indispensable man. It's like, okay, I'm going to, you have these, fanatical followers. They're trained in language. They're trained in some kind of art or skill or diplomacy. And then they go and they make them, or warfare, they make themselves, they serve this other caliph, this other sultan, this other whatever. And that is their devotion because they're ordered by their imam, this representative of God on earth, to serve that person. And so when they're doing that, they're serving their imam, which is serving God, right?
Right.
And so then they rise to the ranks very quickly. And so these sultans, including Saladin, the famous Saladin, he was surrounded by potential traitors, people who were only who had. There was a case where a diplomat came and was saying, you're surrounded by assassins. You must do what we say and stop harassing us, stop trying to take our territory. And, Saladin's like, you're weak, you're nothing, you're heretics as well on top of that. And you're lying to me. And then the guy would say, well, you're actually, you're surrounded, you can't do it. And he challenged him, like, tell me who these assassins are. And he told him, and he had, amongst his closest coterie, he had like five guys who were actually assassins. And they actually said to him, you're only alive because my imam has not told me to kill you yet.
Hmm.
Right. And he put them to death, Saladin put them to death. And then he started marching on the castle, later on. And because, it's constant back and forth. This kind of story happens over and over again. And then finally, as he's almost approached the castle, these terms of a truce are wrapped around a dagger, and the dagger is left next to his bed, in the night. And so he wakes up to find out, once again, he's only alive by the grace of this imam, and he's offering to say that he will not, the terms of the truce was that he would not team up with the Crusaders again. And, that's where this myth of the Crusaders and the Assassins being on the same side started, was that when the Crusaders came, the assassins saw an opportunity, right? I mean, like I said, they had their backs against the wall. They're up on these mountains. They just barely secure these, unreachable castles. And they're hanging on by a thread to maintain themselves in history. And Saladin is this conquering force. And then suddenly they see, out of the blue, come these crusaders. And so they team up with them, and they start coordinating at times, on again, off again, to fight their mutual enemy. And, earlier on when the Bulgarians teamed up with the Fatimids, it didn't mean that the Bulgarians were secretly Ismailis or Muslims, right? It didn't mean that the Fatimids were secretly Christians. Or later on, right, when, like, the Crimean War, for example, 19th century, right, the British were teaming up with the Ottoman Empire to prevent the Russians from extending southward. The Ottomans didn't become Anglicans secretly, right. or vice versa, right? These things happen in history, but unfortunately, this has become a thing in a lot of esoteric circles. Certainly in France, it's very popular amongst Freemasons. There's this guy in the United States named James Wasserman, who wrote, a book that sold a lot called The Templars and the Assassins, or The Assassins and the Templars.
Mm-hmm.
And it proposes this idea, but it's making that leap to say that they are actually on the same side, with no actual sources from Arabic or French or Latin or... or anything. It's all from secondary sources and from kind of pulling it out of the air that he's come up with a solution. But it seems to be a very popular idea.
It's got to be then, they're trying to find, I guess, some form of origin point of the success that the Templars had consequently when they came back. Supposedly they found knowledge. There was, some people speculate it was archaeological in nature. There was, techniques. I mean, this is kind of transferred, as you say, into the, the conspiracy world a little bit, but where basically the Templars, who supposedly kind of started setting up some of the first banking institutions in Europe and made a lot of money on that, they had some kind of secret knowledge of how to, manipulate people and almost kind of like a proto MK Ultra, like a mind control experiment that these Hashashins, which was, as you say, they were fiercely dedicated, but there seems to have been something more to this, that they were manipulated. And so it was almost like trying to create a super soldier, right? There were so few numbers,
right,
that they had to,
right,
have really, really extraordinary skill sets and things like this. And that's kind of some of the overlap, right, that they think, well, the Templars kind of, since they worked together, they also got this knowledge in some way of manipulation, right?
Yeah, I think you're onto something there, and especially that phrase you use, super soldiers, because, I mean, when you look at their stories, I mean, it's hard to believe they're real. It's just like a crazy Hollywood script, or a British boys novel from the 19th century, It's like, I was... How can, nine guys do so much, Has that been possible, I think that there definitely was a lot of cultural sharing, but probably more on the architectural side was probably the most important. I don't know if any of your listeners will ever have the opportunity to travel around on the southern coast of France and Spain or Lebanon or Portugal. There are places as well, but you'll find a lot of remaining architecture that was put in place by the Templars. And in the south of France, I can say that they had a lot of clever new techniques of water management. And in the south of France, that's a place where you have very hot, dry summers. And so, extending your agricultural viability. If you got good hydrology, you're suddenly going to make, you're going to be doing very well compared to your neighbors. And I can see that being something that was developed first in this, area of the world where it's nothing but that.
Right. Yeah.
And then that technology is brought back. And then also the other thing is, these guys didn't have to pay taxes. So, I mean, they answered to the Pope, and they didn't, which is part of that was the beginning of their, or beginning of the end,
the
right? Was yeah. That the kings didn't get their cut, and they answered only to the Pope, and so they were able to. Well, imagine that. I mean, if you're competing, if you have a bunch of companies and one of them doesn't have to pay taxes, you know, that one's going to be on top.
Yep.
After a certain amount of time.
That's right.
I would tend to believe, so there's, I forget her name, there's a British scholar who's proposed this, but if there was any spiritual sharing, her proposal is that it was actually the Mandeans who believed that John the Baptist was more of a Messiah than Jesus, and they also had 3 degrees of initiation. They had this, well, John the Baptist has head cut off, and the Templars had this cult of the head, you know, this bearded man. They had the initiatic rites. You know, to her, she's saying, you know, if, and also, you know, these Mandeans would not be, they might have an open ear to them, right? Especially if they're already, you know, dedicated to St. John, right? Which they were.
Right.
And then it's like, oh, you guys love St. John? Me too. Oh, great. And then it's like, whoa, St. John? Actually, he's Messiah John. You know, that is going to be, what do you mean, right? Not like, you know, whereas if they were running into someone who said, like, something that they already saw as a horrible heresy and a horrible innovation, they might not be, their answer will be, what do you mean? They might just reach for their sword. Because, you know, we're not dealing with intellectually curious guys here. Most of them were illiterate, actually, of the knights. Have you ever had a chance to read their list of rules that they had, actually?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, they I've read that they had different levels of the order, and so if there was any, okay, I'm kind of jumping around on a side topic here, but it's one that's
interesting.
Super interesting. Yeah. So, but I think it's their third order. You know, they had ranks, right? The third order was clerks, and these are the guys who saw their day later on when they were the bankers of Europe, and probably would be the ones who brought an intellectual tradition forward to Scotland, if we're to, you know, believe this Temple and Lodge story. The first order, these were the military guys. You know, they had rules like they were not allowed to learn how to read, even. And they had to wear leather underwear nonstop. They had to sleep in, you know, they had those round temples, right? They slept in those. They always had to have the lights on. And they also were not allowed to bathe. Now, I think that a lot of this was that they were very concerned about the temptation of other men, right?
Uh-oh.
And so they weren't allowed to, which I guess is like, you know, they're out there conquering on the battlefield. They're getting their tea up, but they're not allowed to have wives because they're warrior monks. And so,
right.
You know, what are they going to do about it? And so, they're not allowed to have cells and their own rooms like normal monks.
That's when you begin to worship the Baphomet at some point there. So.
And then the butt kissing stuff, right? Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so they when you read between the lines on all of these rules they had, you know, leave the lights on at night and sleep in a collective common room with no corners, you know, it's like, huh, you know, what are you guys really worried about?
Interesting. <You know? laughs> I haven't thought about that. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's not a, these are not seekers. You see what I mean? That was my read when I
read
these things.
Yeah.
All the same, you know, very dedicated, great warriors. I mean, they stand out from history. But it would be these other guys who were the kind of lower down on the totem pole, who were the clerks, who would have regular interactions with the locals. They had no prescriptions against interacting with the locals. And in fact, they had to, because they had to buy hay for the horses. They have to buy... You know what I mean? They have to arrange passage for pilgrims. They have to do all these other things that require interaction with the local population. They have to be educated. They have to know how to write. And so, that's a vector for sharing of information. and also a vector for finding employees to do stuff, like building an awesome castle. And I was always really skeptical of the whole Temple and Lodge story. You know, this is a story that I'm sure most of the listeners have heard before, of when Jacques de Molay, the last Templar, was burned at the stake, when the order was suppressed in France, but not other countries. They fled to Scotland and then eventually became Freemasons.
Right.
I was always very skeptical of that until the Iraq War. And if you recall, there was the Mahdi army, which was the extreme Shias who followed Muqtada al-Sadr. And they had a peace deal. Everyone got a little piece of the pie when they put a government back in place. And they had to give him something to make him happy and to keep his militia guys, you know, put their guns down, basically. And they gave him the Ministry of Health, right? And it's like, all right, well, it's a weird fit, okay. And then, but, you know, he'll get some money, he'll have some political power, and he should be happy, and they're going to develop this kind of sharing of power between communities, and they'll have to get used to it. But then a few months into it, it starts coming out that, oh, they actually had a police force as part of the Ministry of Health, and in the basement of these hospitals and administrative buildings, they had dungeons and prisons where they were, like, taking their enemies in. Huh. And, you know, when we're, you and I take for granted, because of the societies we grew up in, we take for granted centralized accounting, right? Keeping tabs on different parts of an organization, having a certain level of transparency, knowing that, you know, what they're doing with what money, with what resources, and they're swimming in their own lane, right? But in a society like that, in a chaotic time like that, there's no control of this. And, you know, there was this battle of Bannockburn, right, where there's just, like, suddenly these horsemen came out of nowhere, and they're mysterious, and they weren't nobles who were known, and they saved the day for the King of Scotland. And then suddenly, from the building trades, emerges later this, you know, from these families who had Templar connections, this Freemasonry, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
I thought of that. I thought, well, you know, that was as Muqtada al-Sadr had his Ministry of Health, the king gave these guys, all right, I'll put you in charge of the buildings. And they used that as a power base to make sure all their guys had, you know, a living wage, right? That they could keep their networks tight and keep alive whatever traditions and connections and wealth they wish to keep alive. And that was when I thought, that's a viable story. I can see that working out. I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, obviously, understandably, there's a lot of speculation about this time, that there is some interesting things written by, you know, Robert Lomas and Christopher
yes.
Knight. You know, they've done a lot of good work on this, and there's definitely something to it. It doesn't just, you know, pop out of nowhere and is isolated. It's, of course, the
yeah.
question is how much influence did they have and how, you know, powerful were they? But it's true that there's, you know, they had something which was either, you know, desirable or was seen as some kind of threat, I guess, to the power structure at the time.
Yeah.
They needed to take care of it.
Well, here's the thing. If you and I walk into any library or any bookstore in the United States or in Europe, and we get a comprehensive history of China, that will have stories of secret societies all through it. You know, the White Lotus Society, the Yellow Turbans, the Heaven and Earth Society, the guys who did the Boxer Rebellion, they had some other, it was like Harmony and Righteousness or something like this was their name. You know, it's all these secret societies are forming and then creating the changes in dynasties or the revolutions that they have. And all of them, with the exception of Mao's movement, had a spiritual aspect. But when we open up a history of Europe, we're supposed to believe that this is all fantasy and it can't possibly
right.
exist.
Yeah.
It's got to be somewhere in between. It's got to be, you know, something was happening with this, you know, within the context of these societies. Maybe not our wildest dreams, but you know, but
right.
It, we have to have some kind of openness to the idea, and historians should be allowed to ask questions and follow hypotheses for sure.
Yeah, exactly. What should we squeeze in here at the end of the first segment, Patrick, before we take a short break? I mean, I don't know if we should just kind of maybe even further put this in context of the you know, connections or the links that we're trying to do here between, you know, the ancient world, what happened in the Middle Eastern region, the ascent of Islam, the different factions, the Shia, the Sunni, the kind of more esoteric, metaphysical one. At some point, there's an overlap or communication or something's happening with the from the Crusades, and this Knights Templar order kind of comes out of that environment, or at least when they come back to Europe, that's maybe when it's you know, kind of formed. What else should we tie into that here?
Well, you know, I'd say that, you know, there's much more to the story of the assassins and their survival up to this day, and they are involved in just as much skullduggery and diplomatic connivance throughout the rest of their history. With the Templars, you know, I think that we have maybe one other piece we could touch on in the next bit, since we're on that subject, which would be the born in blood hypothesis about the Peasants' Rebellion, and how much it seems possible. What we have is, you know, we're talking about this kind of closed-mindedness of historians of Europe saying 80 years in the dark, no secret society can manage that. And yet, when we look at the story of the Ishmaili, we see them going 200 years, 250 years, in a period of occultation, they would call it, right? A period of being hidden and practicing taqiyya, right, which is their kind of a holy lie that they tell to survive as a sect. You know, and the way that that our listeners, if they're interested in what they hear, can continue with that story is by becoming members of Red Ice Radio, which when they do so, they get access to over a how many thousands? You did 1,000 shows. This must be like, what, 2,000 hours or so of content that you have?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think every show hasn't been 2 hours, but most of them have, and we're definitely getting up there now above 1,000. So I'd say it's probably like 1,100 shows now at this point. So there's a lot of material. And as you said, Patrick, you know, it's like we've touched on these kinds of subjects for many, many years, you know, the Freemasonic networks, the Knights Templar, the kind of the occult esoteric aspects of this. And although, of course, I don't believe everything that we've covered, there's enough smoke there, you know, to be a fire somewhere, if I can put it that way, that there's something, you know, to it. And it's always fun to revisit some of these topics and tie them in and see that there's a very much a relation still to what's, you know, going on today. And the fact that, you know, these networks is what I, to a certain extent, believe has had tremendous amount of influence in the world, and most people never look in this direction. I think there's a lot to that, you know?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we're probably, my hope is in doing this show with you is that we're going to have a lot of first-time listeners, a lot of young people, a lot of high schoolers who are, you know, fans of the game, who are interested in the movie, and who decided, I want to know something more about this. And I hope that, you know, this overview of history that we've done hasn't assumed too much knowledge on their part already. And I hope that, you know, that we've piqued their interest and that they'll become a member. I mean, it's probably a large pumpkin spice latte is more expensive than being a member of Red Ice Radio, my guess.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And for what they get out of it, it's worth it. And also, I want to point, I always point this out when I come on your show, that you do not monetize your YouTube channel. Everything is from donors only, or not donors, but, you know, subscribers. I mean, they get something out of it, right?
Yeah.
You know, I should say too, you know, I think I had my, you know, my businessman hat on in the past. I always think, man, you know, Henrik, he's leaving money on the table there. That's too bad. I have to say, I see the wisdom of your decision now. I do,
right,
because
right.
Now we're seeing people being kicked off of Twitter for their political views, YouTube videos being shut down because they're asking uncomfortable questions about people in power and the crimes they might be committing. Facebook is just proposed today. I heard a news report of essentially forcing people to get the kind of news that the establishment wants them to hear, and to not allow them to hear news that is contrary to what the establishment wants them to hear. This whole fake news thing. I mean, we are witnessing a closing of the Western mind that could be happening here. The powers that be are shutting things down. And yeah, it was a very wise decision that you made, frankly, of not doing the monetization, because it takes away one more excuse, their easiest excuse, from shutting you down and silencing your voice.
Yeah, that's what they're doing now, right? They're demonetizing videos and things like this. So, you know, it's a kind of a roundabout way that actually they get people to censor themselves. You know, if they've built up a dependency, shall we say, on ads on YouTube, and when they produce content and material, and I'm not criticizing people for that. That's fine. It's their choice.
Right.
I definitely understand it. But it's one more way that they can kind of get to you, basically, if you have that dependency on them. So I've always wanted to do it that way, because I value people's time, and they shouldn't sit there and look at ads, or they shouldn't, you know.
Right.
So it's more of a long-term goal, and I think, as you say, I think we're seeing a closing of that whole the inquisitiveness, the questioning right now. So we're hanging on a thin thread. I mean, in terms of what we'll be able to talk about, payment systems for people who question the establishment, and all these kinds of things. So we're in real danger, folks, and that's why, you know, we need to help out each other when we, you know, at this point when we can. We need to support each other, people who work in these kinds of areas and want to get this kind of information out there before they clamp down too much, because you know, that'll be a death sentence for some people, unfortunately.
Absolutely, and a sentence of ignorance for a lot of potential people out there who could help turn things around for us. You know, I am. I'll also point out, you know, for those who may not be who want a little more free content before making their decision, I also write at Countercurrents. Topics that kind of relate to what we've talked about here. I've written about. I reviewed a memoir of a Freemason in France who wrote about some of the networks there and how plots worked and so on. That he saw, I think it's called, the word escapes me. Masson Franck is the name of the memoir, but I can't remember the title of the article I wrote. But yeah, it's counter-currents.com. And, you know, I've also written about, I'm a strategist, and I'm interested in political movements that are seeking big change. And, you know, I'm part of one in the identitarian movement, this movement against globalization and the wiping out of our people, the placement of our people. And so my interest in groups like the Ismailis or the Templars or others in history is that they have something to teach us about how do you work in an environment where you can't speak freely, where, you know, your livelihood is threatened if you speak freely, and how do you make a change when powers that be seem so entrenched. And
see, that's a really important point. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's really what it's about right there. I think we're facing, to a certain extent, it's the censorship, of course, that they faced at that point was more brutal. It was more physical.
Yeah.
But now it's like the shutting, right? They're shutting people out and shutting them down. And in a way, it's reflective of the same. So you're right. I mean, these are the things we have to think about. What methodologies can we adopt to, you know, go under the radar, continue working, continue to get ideas and ideologies out, and opinions and things like this. So it's a subversive kind of nature to some of the environments, idea wise, that you move in, right?
Absolutely. You know, I guess, you know, here's the thing, is like, whenever we feel daunted, is that we have to remember that those who came before us did more under worse circumstances, and that should keep us in the fight, that knowledge. And we've done a number of shows. I think most of the shows we've done have been talking about Islam in the modern world. And every show is different. You know, we've talked about particular attacks, but we've also talked about the intellectual movements within Islam that have been driving different strategies, different ways that they've organized and to bring their war against the West. I've done podcasts with Greg talking about the psychology and the psychological manipulation of these jihadists by their controllers. We've talked about the identitarian movement in one of the subscribers only hours. And we also did one about, I'd say, the work that I'm most proud of, because I had just the most research and the most interesting analysis, was Jewish demographics and destiny. And that's also another one of the second hours that's only available to the subscribers that we've done. And yeah, and it's also based on a series that I wrote for Countercurrents. But yeah, I really hope, you know, like I said, I it was really a lot of fun to do something on a topic, and we'll do more of it in the second hour, but to do something on a topic that is not following a tragedy. And also, you know, I'm a longtime fan and admirer of your show in all its iterations, and so it's kind of like a throwback Thursday here for me to go into these topics with you after I've listened to so many hours of you interviewing folks, you know, over the last decade or more of your show. So I hope that we've, you know, got some new listeners and piqued interest in folks and maybe pointed the direction in a few paths they can go down. I mean, we're talking about occult warfare here. There's, you know, Julius Evola, the great philosopher. He wrote about occult warfare as well. I mean, there's so many little threads that we've discussed that they can pull on, and there's a world of knowledge there that's available through your show, through Countercurrents, and others like it. So, yeah, thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, thank you, Patrick. You're always very kind and very, you know, generous with both your work and your time and everything else. So I do, folks, encourage you to check out the writing as well, of course, Countercurrents. We'll have a link up to that, and do support, you know, Greg if you can as well, of course. It's very important. As I said, we all help each other out. And if you do want to, you know, get into the second segment here, do go to redicemembers.com. We are, as we've said, now an independent media, so this is the best way to support us. You can acquire membership, and we have tons of material for you there, so do check it out. And it helps, of course, to fund us to expand in our TV broadcasts and fund reports, do more public live broadcasts, and just continue to build out the network and the channel overall. So definitely do check it out. But yeah, stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you on the other side. We will take a short break. We'll be back with Patrick in just a little bit.